Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you with us for our show today. Before we introduce the panel, couple of announcements. As usual, we are on Facebook Live, so you can watch us there. Just go to the GPB News page on Facebook and you'll see the show. We had some problems over the last week with the audio feed on Facebook Live. I think there were some video issues as well, but our crack team of technicians has worked out most of those issues. So we hope you'll check us out. I think you'll find that things are running as they should. At least I hope that's what you'll find. You can also tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Some of you have already begun in anticipation of today's show, and you've offered us some things to talk about. We'll get to that. But then I also want to, if you don't mind, let me just for a second tell you about a show we're doing that I think people who are interested in politics might care about. This is for our other show, Two Way Street. But on Tuesday night, this next Tuesday night, May 8th, we're going to be at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library to record a show in front of a live audience with Joe Crispino. He's the Jimmy Carter Professor of Southern History and American History at Emory. He's been on Political Rewind. Joe's written a new book, Atticus Finch, The Biography. So Jim's already smiling. This book is going to tell us everything we need to know about how Atticus Finch, Jim, went from being a great revered upholder of civil rights to a complete racist in the second book.
Yeah, I want to read that because so far I've just decided not to read the second book.
Yeah, all right. So the point is, if you want to join us, it's free. Just come on over to the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library. Again, we'll start at 7. I think we have a fairly good crowd assembling, so if you want to get a seat, I'd suggest you try to arrive early. Tuesday night, May 8th. Okay, that's enough of my talk. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC, is with us, as he is every Monday and Friday. He's you're going to see him in the Dead Tree edition of the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays. He also oversees the Political Insider blog, part of Politically Georgia, part of my AJC. Hi, Jim.
It's great to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you here. Loretta Lepore, Republican political consultant, government relations expert, former communications director for former governor Sonny Perdue. Thank you for being in here again today.
You're a
regular on Friday, we're glad to say. And then we have two of our favorite Georgia mayors back, and we're so glad they're back together. Teresa Tomlinson, the Democratic mayor of Columbus, Georgia, joins us. Thanks for coming up for the show.
You bet. And you guys are going to be in Columbus on June 7th.
We are. We're going to record a show that evening, Thursday, June 7th, in front of a live audience. And I think you've told us what? You can turn out about 800-900 people for that?
Well, I got you in Legacy Hall of the River Center, so that's a 400-person max. So I'm going to get you 400 people.
And of course, we'll have lots of details about how you all out there can come see the show being recorded that night. Jim, you're coming down for that one, aren't you?
Oh, so far, yeah.
Good, good. We'll have more for you as we get a little closer, but you're right. That's Thursday night, June 7th. And Rusty Paul, the mayor of Sandy Springs, Republican mayor of Sandy Springs, is here. But Rusty is a former chair of the state Republican Party. Before that, he was a close associate of Jack Kemp when Jack was director of HUD in the working with the administration on housing issues. You worked in his campaign.
Right.
So, Rusty, thank you for coming in from Sandy Springs.
Great to be here. It took me almost as long to get here as Teresa from Columbus.
Just going to say that, by the way, Rusty. You pointed out to us that today is a special day.
Yeah, it's May the 4th be with you.
Teresa, when you heard that, you said you didn't figure him to be that corny.
For a cornball. I didn't know he was a cornball, but apparently he is. So.
All right. Let's get to it. We've got lots of really interesting things to talk about today. I want to start, if I can, Jim Galloway. We have not seen in the Democratic fight, we've certainly seen some prickly back and forth between Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans. Right, in-person stuff. But so far, it hasn't been on the airwaves. But now, and we'll play it in a minute, Stacey Evans, who is behind in this race, is starting to take some shots.
Right, right. She's up. She's up this morning with a very large TV buy, a TV attack on Stacey Abrams on the Hope Scholarship.
Yeah. Why don't we play this? Well, do you want to explain
Let's listen first?
Let's play the audio of the spot.
I'm a high school senior who's registered to vote. I'm going to college next year, but a lot of my classmates aren't. I just learned Stacey Abrams cut a deal with Republicans. She stood there with them after eliminating nearly 60,000 Hope scholarships and grants. 97% of African American high school graduates lost access to full scholarships. Ms. Abrams, Georgia students need hope.
I'm Stacey Evans, and as governor, I'll fully restore Hope scholarships for all our kids.
Jim, it is really worth pointing out when people see this spot, that's a young African-American woman.
Staring straight into the camera.
Yeah.
And of course, this is an effort to go after Stacey Abrams' base, which is black female voters, because those are kind of the heart and soul of the Democratic Party.
Before we open it up to the panel, the background on this is what?
This was a 2011 fix to the Hope Scholarship that Republicans said was necessary in order to preserve it. And what was controversial, Abrams was in her first year as minority leader of the Democratic caucus in the House, and she worked with Nathan Deal on the fine points. She says that she preserved, she kept it from being more harmful. Basically, it's interesting. Stacey Evans is focusing on the 97% of full scholarships that were lost to African Americans, but that wasn't the real damage. The real damage was below that to Georgia Technical Colleges. They lost 60% of their funding. They had a 25% decrease in enrollment. I consider it the biggest blunder of Nathan Deal's administration, his 8 years in office. And this goes at Abrams has been pitching herself to Democratic voters as kind of the non-establishment, kind of with a far left approach. And this it kind of conflicts with what her job was as caucus leader in the state house, which was you're the person who cuts these deals, you're the one who works out these compromises.
All right, Teresa, let me turn to the Democrat on the panel first. Mm-hmm. We should point out that Zell Miller, at the time that this deal was cut, and who of course is the creator of the Hope Scholarship. He signed off on this. He said to Governor, he told the legislature, yes, if this is what's necessary to preserve the scholarship, you need to go ahead and do it. But this seems to be another example, and we can talk about more of what's going on here. The fissures and the racial fissures opening up in this Democratic gubernatorial contest, as much as the candidates in their campaigns want to say it's not about race, they are really dramatically opening up, aren't they, in the Democratic contest?
Yeah, what's interesting about this, I think, is normally when you think of an attack ad, it's some sort of a dark background, maybe a storm cloud, and this ominous male voice saying something horrible about the other person with very unflattering pictures about your opponent. And this is a charming young woman talking about her educational opportunities. And so it comes across a lot softer, by the way, I think, when people see it. So it's, as far as the technical aspects of putting this together and the creative aspects of putting it together, they did a very good job at delivering a harsh message, I think. And so it may not go over as heavy-handed. There have been a lot of racial back and forth, as you know. There was a tweet that was posted by an Abrams staffer that was then taken down and she was reprimanded for and so forth. I'll say as we go forward, and Rusty made a point I'm sure he'll make here in a moment, is that this is the final stretch. And when you're in second place in a primary, you got to move the needle. Evans has the money to move the needle. Abrams raised more money, but she only has about $400,000 on hand, and the majority of that has been earmarked for the general. So I don't know what she's running in the Metro Atlanta area, but Stacey Evans is on the airwaves outside of Metro Atlanta. We're seeing her regularly. So it's going to be interesting to see if the needle indeed can be moved.
Yeah, I mean, Rusty, you said it. We're just a little over 2 weeks away from Election Day.
Yep. And I come bearing news. First of all, it's my job to encourage this kind of behavior. Secondly, I actually had lunch with Stacey Evans, and I hadn't seen the ad until I actually got here. But she said, yeah, we're going to do a little bit of contrast. And over lunch, she was talking a lot about the damage that had been done to the technical colleges in the state. that they bore a disproportionate problem. And with the workforce challenges that the construction industry and a lot of other industries are having, that are key job producers. And in fact, Amazon can't come to Georgia if you can't build a building. So I think she's probably got a line of attack that's going to be interesting to watch over the next few weeks.
You know, Loretta, the other thing we've watched unfold this week is a controversy about, while she was minority leader in the state house, there was an off-year reapportionment in 2015. 17 districts were redrawn by the Republican leadership. Stacey Abrams went along with this, said, okay, I'll support you on this. And apparently, we think maybe didn't learn until later that the way in which these new districts were drawn was to enhance the strength of Republican incumbents, but to fence off and corral the strength of African-American voters, to put them into separate districts so that they couldn't dilute the vote of the Republican incumbent. Now, this has been going back and forth all week.
Right.
And I don't think it's going to have a big impact on the voter personally, although I want the take of all of you, but it certainly does say something about fissures opening up in the Democratic Party.
Well, I think what Stacey Evans is doing here with this ad is taking another shot at Stacey Abrams' leadership credentials, right? So you pair up the redistricting conversation with now this ad, which speaks to her support of perhaps not leading her caucus in the right direction on the Hope, in this case, Hope Grants. So their Hope Scholarship for higher ed, Hope Grants for technical colleges. And so she's painting this picture, and her supporters, with the aid of Senator Vincent Fort, who was also instrumental in this Hope discussion on the Senate side and the redistricting conversation on the Senate side, who's endorsed Stacey Evans. He's sort of coming up as a third party advocate for Stacey Evans and reinforcing some of these messages.
Vincent says that he was furious when that reapportionment bill came to the Senate, African-American Vincent Fort,
right,
to see what Stacey Abrams had agreed to.
Right. So you see this as a message. And then you also see in this ad that Stacey Evans is doing is it's a very simple message. I mean, she's been running a very simple campaign about hope and about opportunity. That's her message. And everything she does goes back to that singular message. And you could talk about whether that's too narrow a field for her or too narrow an issue, but it is being effective. And she has offline advertising and social media ads that are simple too. So she ran one that I thought was highly effective to differentiate the two, where it was E is for education, E is for Evans. And, you know, when you think about the fact that she's been endorsed by Paul Begala, Paul Begala was one of the inventors of it's the economy, stupid.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And how simple a message was that, you know? So I think you're seeing some threads here, and you're seeing her trying to name ID out in this race, for one, to separate, but also staying steadfast to her message.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you think I'm correct that the voters aren't going to care much about the back and forth over whether Stacey Abrams deliberately allowed African-American strength to be minimized in certain districts, and this says more about the internal party politics?
Well, first of all, what Stacey Abrams is saying about this was that she was duped, that she was misled by the House reapportionment chairman, Randy Nix of LaGrange, who's a Republican. And there was some terrific pushback on that from the House Speaker, David Ralston.
anytime somebody comes from my opposite party wanting to adjust lines, every nerve in my body's alive because I know something bad is about to happen. So, I mean, to say that you were duped.
Yeah, but well, and okay, I'm sorry, you've been trying to jump in here.
I was just going to say Stacey Abrams is a skeptic, and my goodness, she is smart. And so that doesn't fit well, but as Jim pointed out, they are just a list of coordinates. But nevertheless, you think you would have immediately taken it and gone and drilled down a bit. You know, a couple of things. Michael Thurman was on earlier this week, and he said expect some prominent African-American support for Stacey Evans to come out this week. I think you're going to see that. And I know people want to simplify. They just want to talk about race because they understand that. They can categorize that in their mind, and they think they know what that means. If we were talking about Shirley Franklin versus Stacey Evans, we wouldn't even be having a conversation.
Why?
Right now. Because of there is there have been some very turbulent times with the Black Caucus in the House of Representatives. That has rippled out into the community. And so, as any strong leader, there's been enemies made along the way, and that there are steadfast in some of the African-American community. And so you see, and as some of the African-American leaders have been talking about, people are picking sides. Vincent Ford, some others you're going to see coming out. And so I read, I think it was the New York Magazine article, it said Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans are splitting the African-American community. That can't possibly be right. If that's true, then this is over.
Then Stacey Evans becomes the candidate.
So she's, in my estimation, she's looking, Stacey Evans is looking to clip off through some of this, through drawing some question about the actual bona fides of leadership towards African-American causes.
The poll that the AJC and Channel 2 put out 2 weeks ago on this race had Abrams at 38% with African-American voters and Evans with 10%, which means there are plenty of undecideds there.
About 50%. Mm-hmm. About 50% undecided. I tell you, I'm not in the habit of giving my adversaries advice, but I can tell you that Stacey Evans would be the most difficult candidate for the Republicans to take on in the fall. She's got a great story. She's got a lot going for her in a general election. And because of Stacey Abrams' kind of identity politics approach, I don't think that's going to play as well as maybe Stacey Evans' story that she's got and the thing that she's saying.
I would say with this ad, one of the things, and Teresa mentioned this, is the optics of this ad. The production value of this ad is really important because they're both the young woman that speaks first and then Stacey Evans herself are speaking head on, and it's very intimate. And so it is clearly going to women. And you have 40% of Republican women undecided at this point. And so there is also, she's shooting across the bow. She's not only going after Democrats, she's going after independent women, potentially, who she could pull in, and potentially some of those Republican women, that suburban Republican women, of which she is one, that are sitting on the fence. And if she pulls them in the primary, they're likely to stick with her in the general if she makes it to the general. So, you know, there's even probably a little bit of a broader brush with this ad than in previous ads.
So, you talk about the power of the simple message of Stacey Evans. I mentioned on the show Wednesday, and I'd love to get all of you to give me some feedback on this. There is a powerful message working for Stacey Abrams right now, too, and it does have it is a racial message in some ways, but it's not a negative racial message. This is a woman who could become the first African American governor in the country and bring with it all that implies in terms of her hope to reach out and help improve the lot of African American. That's a very powerful motivator, isn't it, Jim?
It's a very powerful motivator beyond the state boundaries. And as you get down to the grassroots, yes, it's a very, very powerful message. When you get up to the people who know how a general election works in Georgia, it becomes a tougher sell.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Teresa, how's that going to work down your way?
Well, I was going to say, you know, I ran against a very prominent, very attractive candidate for mayor the first time around, African-American, in a runoff. And I did end up splitting the African-American vote. And I did not run as first woman mayor. He did run as first African-American mayor a great deal in some of his media. And so I found, my personal opinion is, people want the best leader for the time. And African-American voters, to generalize, are very savvy voters. They're very civically engaged. They know their candidates. They know who's going to work their issues and who's experienced. And so I think some of that, when you're talking about a Barack Obama, when you're talking about something that's so historic, yes, it's going to be a motivator for turnout. I'm not sensing a large turnout, and I don't know what everybody else's impression is. I'm not sensing a large turnout for this May 22nd election.
Let me, if Bill, before we went on the air, we were talking about precedents here, and there was the 2008 Democratic race for U.S. Senate to mount a challenge to Saxby Chambliss, and the two candidates that were in the runoff were Jim Martin, a white Democrat, and Vernon Jones, the former CEO of DeKalb County, And in that contest, you saw people like Andy Young and Joe Lowry get up and direct their voters, their supporters toward Jim Martin. The problem with replicating that right now is that Stacey Abrams has already wrapped up the John Lewis's, the Hank Johnson's. They're out there for her. Not, you know, you're not seeing the Andy Youngs or Kasim Reeds or Mayor Bottoms out there yet. But she's got some people out there for her.
Let me. Olivia Rheingold is in the control room producing today's show, and she's been monitoring Facebook Live, and we have some interesting comments that I'll throw out to the panel. Larry Lowe says, "I'm starting to get hope fatigue." We don't know if Larry Lowe is a Republican or a Democrat. He says he, as a transplant with no to Georgia, I assume, with no children, Evans' hope message doesn't impact me. And then Laura Adams says, agreed, the Evans message has been too narrow. Hope originated after I finished college. It's never been of much benefit to my family, nor with pre-K. So, I mean, I think there are many, many Georgians, Rusty, with children for whom hope is very, very important, but here is a minority report.
Well, I had five children, and I used to play the lottery every week. Now I've quit, so that that pretty much tells you where I am and a lot of other people. But I think that hope is still a very significant thing in this state.
Yeah, sure.
I agree. I think that Stacey Evans' message is a little narrow. It's probably a little late in the game to start expanding it. But when you've got limited resources in a campaign, you got to pick one idea and push it. And I think that's what she's chosen, that one, and she's going to live or die on it.
Well, I think the hope message for higher ed is, you know, to Rusty's point, is what he's speaking with. But when you're talking about the hope grants and the technical colleges, we have such a skills gap in this state. And to Governor Deal's credit on this issue, he has been appropriating dollars throughout the subsequent years to those programs and those HOPE grant programs that fill and mirror and match up with our deficits in skills. So nursing, child, you know, pre-K workers, construction was one of the latest rounds. So where we have skills gaps is where he has augmented HOPE grants. And that's trying to mirror and eliminate the skills gap across the state. That is important to a lot of people that are trying to retrain for employment.
All right. I got to get to a break. Tyler Morris is in there at the board, audio board, looking at me like, when are you going to take a break? We're going to do it right now, Tyler.
This spring, we're counting on the participation of everyone who listens to cover the rising costs of the programs we bring you on GPB. We've already wrapped up our fund drive, but there's still time to support the programs you rely on and enjoy. Please take a moment now to do your part. Go to gpb.org and click donate at the top of the page. Your contribution, at whatever level is right for you, will help cover the costs of the programs you love on GPB. Thank you so much for your support of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway from the AJC with me. This is our two mayors show. Rusty Paul from Sandy Springs, Teresa Tomlinson from Columbus. Always glad to have you together. And it's Friday, which means Loretta Lepore is with us as well. Rusty and Teresa, the governor has until May 8th, I believe, to dispose of all of the bills that are left on his desk after the legislature passed them. And one of them that we're still waiting to hear what he might do with is Stockbridge Eagles Landing. This is the measure that would allow the people of the community of Eagles Landing to set themselves free from the city of Stockbridge and form their own municipality. As mayor of Sandy Springs, and then we'll get Teresa's take, is this a dangerous precedent?
Yeah, I'm invading Buckhead. I'm coming to get it. I think the one thing that happened, though, subsequently, that nobody paid any attention to, it's when the bond rating agency said, guys, if you can split up one city, you can split up others, and that's going to really impact your bond rating. And there is nothing that is more sacred in this state than the AAA bond rating that every governor's passed on to his successor. And that's got to give everybody a pause. If it just take out the fact that you're splitting a very long established community for a variety of reasons, some of which are not necessarily savory, and that should give everybody a pause to think whether we should be doing that sort of thing.
Teresa?
Well, of course, I come from a consolidated government, of which I'm a huge fan of. And so I've always sort of shook my head at this business of slicing and dicing these counties into 13, 14, 15 cities. But, you know, they seem to go their own way, and it makes sense for them. And so who am I to pass judgment? I would say that I'm a little surprised that just now people are noticing sort of the racial disparity and income disparity in this process. I grew up in DeKalb County. I think through many, many tenures of dysfunctional government until they got the wonderful Michael Thurman, people felt a little desperate, like they needed to have another access to some other type of government, and that was the cause there. But I think it's highly inefficient. I think people end up paying a lot more. I mean, you know, in Columbus, you get city and county services at operational services at $700 per person. I think that's the best per capita in the state, and I would say it's because we're consolidated.
And there's Bill, there's a certain connection between this and the fight over the 2015 redistricting that we've just finished talking about, because the two main districts that are the subject of the federal lawsuit from that redistricting, one is in Gwinnett County, but the other's is District 111 in Henry County, which Republicans were able to hold on to. And Brian Strickland, who was reelected in 2016, was the guy who introduced the Stockbridge Eagles Landing legislation.
We should point out, Loretta, that one of the reasons people are paying particular attention to this is this would be the first time this has ever happened in the state of Georgia. If the governor signs this bill, it does establish, sets a precedent for other communities to essentially declare their independence if they can get the legislature to go along. And so we very well might. The next step is the city of Buckhead.
All right. And I just want to let Rusty know that the Buckhead mayor, Sam Macell, is on the line for him, holding, because this is, you know, I've been a resident of Buckhead a long time, and this is one of his primary concerns, because we've had for years this discussion about Milton and, you know, pushing back on that. And so, you know, this will resonate. Plus, you have some fiduciary issues here concerning bond ratings, which will impact cities, in particular these communities in question for this bill. And at a state level, you know, the bond rating, most people don't see the implications of the bond rating on a daily basis, but it really is a foundational element for our economic success and our economic sustainability, because it allows the state to approve funding for roads and infrastructure, for education, for construction of higher ed buildings, these sorts of things that all of us as Georgians experience on a daily basis, but we never tie back. And Georgia is one of the few states that has been able to maintain that through two economic downturns.
Well, the bonds are important at another level, and this is why it's very crucial. I mean, when you go out to recruit businesses to come into the state, they want to know how well you are being managed financially. And that AAA rating, when they hold that thing up, that is the gold standard for how you manage your fiscal house. And to do something that would jeopardize that, I mean, that would have ramifications for Amazon and other major corporations looking at coming here.
Which is one of the reasons, Jim, the governor might be a little concerned about whether he wants to move forward with this.
Right. If you talk to Stockbridge City officials, they say they've got about $14 million in outstanding debt. They don't have any property tax, by the way. But the removal of the Eagles Landing territory would cut away half their tax digest. So how do they, where does that debt remain? Does it remain with the city of Stockbridge, or does it get transferred over to Eagles Landing? Those are questions that it's not addressed in the legislation.
So the governor's got to do something by Tuesday on that. Let me, Brian Toler, who is a lobbyist down at the Capitol, sent a tweet before the show. Looking forward to Governor Deal signing HB 876, reversing local bans on using lumber for certain approved construction projects. Rusty and Teresa, we talked about this the last time the two of you were in. First of all, just because of the very nature of what the bill would do, Rusty.
Right. Well, and I fully expect the governor is going to sign it. I mean, it was overwhelmingly approved in both chambers. I don't think they really understood the ramifications of this, though. By restricting local jurisdictions only to the minimum standards, if you're on the coast of Georgia and you got a Cat 1, 2, 3, or 4 hurricane coming at you, you don't want minimum standards.
This means that you, as the city of Sandy Springs, you as the city of Columbus, cannot set higher standards. Right. You have to go along with the minimum standards set by the state.
And what place on the planet aspires to minimum standards?
Yeah.
Particularly a state like Georgia.
And Teresa, the big story, the reason we got into a very extended and important conversation the last time we discussed this goes to this whole issue of state dictating increasingly what you in a municipality can and cannot
do. So it's Republicans that kill the laboratory of democracy. You know, you gotta love the hypocrisy of it, which usually is your first clue that you're a little off track. If the pandering to particular industry sectors just becomes so obvious in it, and again, not looking at the broader picture. But if there's few things that if there's a few things that localities do very, very well, it's pass local ordinances that enforce things related to safety, building, and zoning of how their people live.
Yeah, no, I mean, we should go into just a little bit of detail, Bill. This is a forest industry bill, and the crucial point that Rusty and Mayor Tomlinson disagree with is that the state allows, your minimum standards allows structures up to 5 stories to be built out of wood.
Right.
And you can see that would be a problem on the coast. And it's also a problem if you don't have hook and ladders that reach up that high.
But it's good news for the forestry industry, isn't it?
Well, we actually, my fire marshal is the one who tipped me off to this. He said, we don't have any Georgia lumber being used in Sandy Springs. It's all coming from Canada and Idaho and Oregon. And we went out and started looking, and sure enough, there was none. We don't allow it to get big enough to be saw timber in the state. We harvest it before, so it becomes pulpwood.
But you believe the governor's going to sign this?
I do. I mean, I talked to some people this morning who had was on my side of this issue, and they said, yeah, he's going to sign it.
All right, let me go after another issue for a couple of minutes here. Tom Price was in the news again. It's been a while since he left HHS as secretary. But he was back in the news because he gave a speech the other day to a conference of healthcare professionals in which it was widely reported. He said, if you eliminate the individual mandate, it's absolutely correct. Premiums will go up because young people, healthy people will drop out of the pool, and therefore older people like Galloway and me will end up having to pay higher premiums. Now, that got some headlines. He subsequently said, you took that so out of context. I was so misquoted on that, Jim.
Yeah, and I think if he didn't say it, what he probably meant to say is that our plan to eliminate the mandate and yet restructure the healthcare exchanges that states have, that was the plan. We did the first, we didn't do the second, and that's where the problem lies.
He wrote an op-ed piece, actually, to try to correct the record for The Hill. He said, in today's era of gotcha politics, my recent remarks were taken completely out of context, having made the common-sense observation that absent other reforms, I noted that Obamacare patients will have to bear more of their own health care costs as a result. Now, I didn't read the transcript of this, so maybe he's making a case here. Maybe not, Teresa.
Well, of course, everybody jumped on just the smacking, hypocrisy once again of him reversing course now that he's out of that particular position and realizing the economic reality that everybody else realized is that eliminating this mandate was going to have an effect on the market. And I think conservatives are just now either figuring out or admitting that they did not understand the healthcare market when they were going through this debate the first time. It is not a free market, and the whole purpose, it has barriers to entry, it has super profits, it has inaccessible information for the consumers. You can go on and on and on. But what the ACA was trying to do was create a public framework in which private participants could come in and more efficiently and effectively work for the benefit of our citizens. And so for some reason, which is frankly a nice balanced proposal, the conservatives didn't like that. They fought against it to the death, 60-something attempts to repeal ACA. And then when they got control of both houses and the White House, that's what they intended to do. So, you know, 600,000 people in Georgia have been harmed by this, the failure to expand Medicaid. 8 rural hospitals have gone under in recent years. There's been jobs lost in communities that would have benefited from a full embrace of the ACA, which was, I think, a very balanced, politically balanced proposal.
Well, I probably spent more as much time in private with Tom Price as anybody at this table talking about politics and issues and so on. And I don't doubt that he said something to the effect, because the truth is, if we require everybody to have auto insurance driving down the road. And the challenge economically is if right now we have a certain percentage of people who are not covered, and the people who are covered are paying for that. So the cost goes up to those folks when other people aren't paying. Having some kind of mandate, I think, is not something the conservatives reacted against. It was the type of mandate. My wife and I are, I'm in my 60s. I let my wife talk for herself. But I can assure you, we are having no more children, and we were having to pay for maternity care. That's the problem.
We all know.
But that's insurance.
We know Jan. Couldn't be over 37, yeah, 38.
But she's put me out in the pasture, so that's all right.
I just have to say, I pay for prostate exams. I mean, you know, come on, guys.
You got one of those at home that's still preferably working, I guess.
That's the point. That's the point of insurance, is that we pool our risk. We come together and we say, all right, you may have a family history of cancer. I may have a family history of diabetes. You know, we're going to pool our risk. We're going to figure this out. You're younger, you're healthier, I'm older, I need a little bit more help. That's the point. One, of the social contract, which you don't hear a lot of talk about anymore. And two, insurance.
You know, Loretta, one of the other things, though, that I think about when I see Tom Price in a controversy that makes some news again is, do Republicans really want their failure to get what they wanted in overturning Obamacare to come back to haunt them in an election season?
Well, no, because I think that they wanted to be moving toward reform, and they did it in a piecemeal fashion. We have a real hot mess on our hands right now. And, you know, I'm personally very passionate about the individual market, because I think that, you know, the repeal of the individual mandate, you know, there shouldn't be a mandate. The young people were not signing up even when Obamacare was in full force. They were opting for the penalty because it was less expensive. If they didn't think they needed health care, they weren't going to buy health care, and they were going to take the hit with the IRS and take the penalty because it was far less. So, but what has happened is you have this whole individual marketplace where in the regional metropolitan area, you have two choices of insurers. And I can guarantee you that 99.9% of the people that have had to choose between those two, myself included, has lost every one of their doctors.
Yeah.
And so you're starting fresh with new doctors, you're paying higher premiums, and it is disproportionately affecting females between the ages of 50 and 65. This affects female business owners. Okay, so that's a pretty high cost. So the ripple effect is, do you continue to stay in business or go work for somewhere else where you be part of a group plan? Yeah. And not have to pay so much.
But can we just agree that this is what government does? This is the point and purpose of government.
Well, the last time that Teresa and I argued about this particular point, I pointed out that before Obamacare, my premium each month was $800 a month. And 3 years later, it was $2,100 a month.
Yeah.
That's not a success in my book.
Had they expanded Medicaid?
Thank you both for making my point, Mr. Galloway. The Republicans thought they would be able to run in the midterm elections on two things. Number one, yep, we did it. We got rid of Obamacare. Two, we redid the tax code. And they can't run on the tax reform because apparently every poll suggests that Americans don't believe it's in their best interest. And by renewing this debate over Obamacare, they simply remind voters that they weren't able to do that either.
No, and now the one bright spot here is, of course, is unemployment is looking pretty darn good.
Yes, and we're down to 3.9% according to today's report on jobs, and that's a very big deal for the Republicans.
And quite frankly, I mean, the tax cut, people, I don't see what I earn every day, every week now. I never see a pay stub. Nobody else gets a pay stub. So the outward signs like that unemployment rate, that's what starts to matter, I think, more than anything else. I think, and I think you're going to see Republicans start talking a little bit more about that.
All right, we got to get to another break. As we go to break, by the way, an announcement from the Trump administration about a Georgian who most people here think very highly of. The Trump administration today announced it was appointing retired UGA football star Herschel Walker to a two-year post on a presidential sports council. Walker has always been a friend of the president. They've had a relationship for any number of years, and so congratulations.
Trump owned the football team, didn't he? The New Jersey Generals that Herschel played for.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, I'm just kind of I'm kind of surprised that he didn't appoint Herschel as FBI director, because that's where Herschel wanted to go.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right, let's get a second break out of the way, and we'll come back with a lot more on Political Rewind.
If you recently supported GPB during our spring fund drive, thank you. We're already putting your dollars to work to bring you the programs that you've come to expect and enjoy from GPB. If you didn't get a chance to donate during the drive, your online contribution now will still make a difference. Please take a couple of minutes to go to our website, gpb.org, and click the green donate button at the top of the page. And thanks so much for your generous support of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
I'm Ira Flatto. On the next Science Friday, New Horizons mission scientist Alan Stern and astrobiologist David Grinspoon join us to paint the picture of Pluto, the ninth planet.
Yes, it still is to them. We'll hear the story why. Plus, we know you think your dog is very smart, but just what is he thinking about? It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I want to mention this just so we don't not get to it because we've run out of time. We have an interesting announcement in terms of those of us who have been involved in journalism and politics for a very long time. Jim Galloway, our friend and colleague over at WABE, Dennis O'Hare, just announced he's their morning edition host, of course, longtime political reporter, a great competitor, just announced he's retiring.
After 40 years in journalism in Atlanta, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he started with WGST radio, when it was a really good news radio station, then jumped to WXIA, and then to WABE.
He's going to stay on as a political analyst or whatever. I'm not sure what exactly the language is, but he'll be continuing to do politics for them. I pointed out when Jim told me about this before the show that I am going to end up being the oldest by far active journalist. And I think you made the perfect comeback, Jim, which was
that doesn't change with Dennis.
I'm already the oldest.
Bet you are. Yeah. All right.
Jim, let me stay with you for a sec. So interesting story that you, Tamar Hallerman, did in the AJC. The Daily Beast reported on this, too. We all know that it was Johnny Isaacson's Veteran Affairs Committee that ended up not wanting to move forward with the nomination of Ronny Jackson, even before Ronny Jackson dropped out himself as a potential head of the VA. All of the criticism that came out of the White House was focused on the ranking member, the Democrat, and that was John Tester of Montana. Right. A pro-Trump PAC has already begun running attack ads against Senator Tester as he works toward his reelection. But now it turns out that the president, according to Tamar and to Daily Beast, is quietly fuming about Johnny Isaacson as well.
Right. And if you're Johnny Isaacson, you're saying, well, what did you expect? Yeah. Because he went in to see Trump to say, David Shulkin is doing a fine job. Stick with him, and you'll be fine. Trump decided not to do that. There was talk about using a Fox News host to replace him. Johnny said no. Then came Ronny Jackson, and all sorts of problems began jumping up. And I don't think we've seen the end of it yet. And so now you have Isaacson waiting for Trump's next move.
Yeah, we've been told very reliably that there was a lot more on Ronny Jackson than was reported at the time. Whether that ever comes out now, whether it needs to or not, is maybe beside the point. But apparently there was a lot more. What's interesting about this, Loretta, is that there was some thought that perhaps Isaacson was willing to let Ronny Jackson come before the committee and let him go through a tough experience to sort of make a point with the president. Now, we don't know if that's in fact true or not, but there does seem to be reporting that suggests that might have been happening if Tester hadn't started talking about it so publicly.
Well, it's my understanding that, and in some of the reporting, that the White House was upset that Senator Isaacson didn't give the White House a heads up on some of this stuff, or that this is what was going to happen. And in fact, Senator Isaacson did reach out to John Kelly to let him know that there, some of these reports were surfacing, and the chief of staff said, move forward. And so that is where that was. I think it would have been more embarrassing for the White House had the hearing gone forward. And I do think that Senator Isaacson was trying to offset some of that. But it's not surprising that there's some discontent with the president.
Rusty, does the president have anyone to blame but himself on this one, particularly in terms of the lack of vetting of Ronnie Jackson?
Yeah, no, that's one of the basic things that you should do. I mean, I got to believe that Donald Trump has hired a lot of people in his lifetime, in his private sector career. You always want to go through and vet people, and you want to get references, and you want to do all this sort of stuff. The interesting thing was that President Obama had given this guy glowing recommendations, had told the Pentagon to promote him ahead of his class. So that was, so it leaves the ordinary person like myself kind of confused about what was really the story here.
I think it's going to be interesting, Teresa, to see how much of a role the president or the administration, whoever's going to make these decisions, gives to Isaacson as they look for a new nominee for the VA job. That's a hugely second biggest department of government. They've got to find somebody quickly.
I would just say, Mr. Trump, you are way out of your depth here. You have neither the dignity nor the stature to go and tango with Johnny Isaacson. And so I hope he proceeds very, very carefully, if that is the scuttlebutt coming out of the White House, that he will not fare well. I, too, am hearing, I think everybody's hearing, that sources very close to the story have let it be known that there is more there. And I think they're holding back because at this point, the man has left his job. He's no longer even White House counsel. He's sort of on a leave status.
He's no longer the
doctor.
Let's be careful. He's no longer the president's personal physician.
Exactly.
He is still on that staff.
And so he's taking a little sabbatical while he's being investigated by the Inspector General of the Pentagon. And so I think people are just going to let him go if he chooses to go, if he reenters, or if Trump picks this back up, then the man will be tried publicly.
Well, right before we came on the air, Vice President Pence's doctor also stepped down.
Yes.
So, and they report into the same office in the Pentagon. And so this investigation, or whatever they're doing to investigate these claims, is potentially having a broader impact.
I love it. And I think I will tell you what they're probably looking at. It's not the DUI that it's not that. It's the distribution of drugs without prescriptions.
Well, I think the Secret Service has already said that the accident didn't occur. So the thing that bothers me about this, though, is the way that, and this goes back to something we talked about last time we were here, the level of civic discourse, having a U.S. senator go out and having no real basis for attacking somebody, there's a way to do that. And I just see this sort of character assassination has so permeated our political life today that nobody thinks anything about
well,
it.
Well, I would take exception that there's no basis. As I said, I think there's more there. And there also are some reported very serious HIPAA violations. And that may, actually, it is related to some records related to the Pences. And so that there may be some connection there. So it may be the distribution of drugs. It may be these HIPAA violations. It could be the use of alcohol on the job. However, that is described, because when you're going to China or the Mideast with somebody, if you have any drink during any time, which it was wheels up and wheels down, I guess that's on the job. Yeah. But there's more there.
Jim, I would also note that, again, going back to the drug distribution, you've got a major opioid crisis in the United States right now. You've got Lamar Alexander and Johnny Isaacson as co-authors of a bill to address that very thing. To bring Ronnie Jackson in front of Isaacson in that kind of climate, would not have gone well.
Right. Yeah. All right. We got 2 minutes left. And Teresa Tomlinson, I'm going to give it to you first, the Democrat in the room. President Trump, for those of you who have not heard yet, was on his way to the NRA convention in Texas. He had a few minutes to answer shouted questions from reporters in front of the White House and then getting off of Marine or getting on to Marine One, one or the other. And Teresa, he essentially said, you've got it wrong. If you think that I said I didn't know anything, you better go back. I never said I didn't know anything about Stormy Daniels or a payment to her. And he's now saying that he and Rudy Giuliani are going to change their story again.
Yeah. Well, this is where the nerd in me comes out, because this stuff is important. Government is not a joke, and politics is not Dungeons and Dragons. I understand the real world. I understand strategy. But we have a president that is incapable of telling the truth about anything. And so, to me, it's not about the porn star. It's not about, well, the payments are probably illegal. They keep changing the story, but every iteration is equally as unlawful as the prior iteration, because anytime you're talking about transferring money, it has to be characterized. And once you start characterizing it, that will relieve the illegality. But let me just say that I think that President Trump is going to be impeached. And I don't say that politically. I say that because of the investigations.
Right. Let me, Rusty, let you jump in. There, no Republican can be happy to have watched what happened this week. The question is what you want to see done about it.
Well, the challenge is there's no question that Donald Trump is rewriting all the rules of politics that I have ever known and tried to live by. That I thought was, you know, the safe thing to do politically. I mean, political correctness has gone out the window with this guy. I don't know. It's I shake my head every morning when I watch TV about it. But I tell you what, his base is sticking with him through thick and thin. It's interesting. It's a fascinating thing as a political scientist to watch.
Yeah. Is it catch up with him at some point, do you think, Loretta?
I don't know that. What I do think is that if you take a step back from all of these individual little crises and legal matters, is that the American people are getting very weary. They're just very weary, and they just want their government to work. They want some things to get done. And I think the unfortunate thing here is that the economy is doing so well, and there are other good things happening, and there's none of that is coming out. And we can't get on with the business of the work the government should be doing, because everything's embroiled in this and people just want to know.
Jim, you get the last word in today's show.
I think if you say A and then go to B and then go to A to B, A to B to C to D, then ultimately people don't know what to think. And I think that's part of the plan.
All right. Well enough. Thank you for giving us a way to go out of the show today. We are completely out of time. Loretta Lepore, Mayor Teresa Tomlinson, Mayor Rusty Paul, love having you all in for the show. Jim, we're going to see you back here for another Political Rewind on Monday. If you can't hear it on the radio on Monday, you can always subscribe to the Political Rewind podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. My thanks to Tyler Morris and Olivia Rheingold for your work today. Tom Faust is home, not feeling great. Tom, get better and come back on Monday. We'll see you all then. Take care.